take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
I've been a throw up the sex in a and I can put you in.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your coulda kept it niche of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Throw up the sex in a
A first class episode today. LOL. We're going to talk about Jack Harlow. I've been wanting to do a Harlow episode for a while. As you know, I interviewed Jack Harlow for a profile a few weeks ago, and I've been wanting to circle back. But every time I've been about to schedule this episode, some new thing has happened with Jack Harlow. It's been a bit of a up and down summer for Harlow. And so now that that seems to have calmed down a tiny bit, we're finally coming back with a full episode. So we're going to do two segments today. First, Hunter Harris, Larisha Paul are going to be here. We're going to talk about the Harlow album, the Harlow rollout, the Harlow charisma, the Harlow meta narrative, the marketing narrative, etc. Just the big picture of how he is pitching himself and being pitched in this moment. And then after that, Peter Rosenberg is going to show up and we're going to talk about the taxonomy of white rappers and where Jack Harlow fits in those narratives. It's going to be a rowdy, uproarious, boisterous episode, and let's just get right into it. At the top of the episode, you were listening to First Class. That's Jack Harlow's big hit from this year. It has been an eventful summer for Jack Harlow, which means an eventful podcast for Jack Harlow, which means Hunter Harris is here. Hunter.
Hi.
Hunter writes the Hung Up newsletter, podcast veteran. We're happy to have Hunter back. Also, Larisha Paul is here.
Hello.
Larisha, also a podcast veteran, writes about music for Billboard and Rolling Stone and Fader, wrote a piece about Jack's Drakeification, which is very on point. Hunter, you just were saying something a minute ago about Jack's chaotic summer. Let's get into it.
So when I'm thinking of Jack Harlow's chaotic summer, it starts with the Teen Vogue cover where he is styled in a very like Y2K kind of, it reminded me of Xenon, Girl of the 21st Century. That's like sort of what the styling was like. And it's like a pretty good piece that lets him really just kind of say a lot and bury himself with his own words in a kind of funny way. And then, of course, like the Brandy stuff. And then that kind of reached its conclusion when he invited her on stage to perform with him at the BET Awards, which I don't know. What did you guys think of that performance?
I feel like Brandy watched him in a really funny way, just because no one there was more excited about seeing him than they were about seeing her. And I think having that follow him performing Poison, which is one of the songs on Come Home, the Kids Miss You, that just sounds like a 2009 Drake throwaway. It didn't help his case necessarily. None of them were performances that were like really showcasing him as a rapper, which seems like the thing that he wants to do more than anything. But then he gets these opportunities to go on stage and do that in front of the people whose respect he wants and whose cosigns he wants. And then he sings alongside Lil Wayne and then gets out rapped by Brandy.
This is the anxiety a little bit of the Harlow rollout, which is basically he's the only white performer, I'm pretty sure, the only white performer at the BET Awards, very carefully interested in cultivating and being appropriately reverent in front of that audience. And yet, even for me, like with the dance routines, are you a rapper who dances? And again, not that rappers can't dance or whatever, but for a rapper who has privileged and prioritized, like, hey, I really spit, I really write bars, I really do this, it's clear that there's like conflicting advice. I feel like there's conflicting impulses at play. That's how that performance felt to me. And the Brandy thing, obviously it's the resolution of a long arc where he did not know that Brandy and Ray J were siblings. And then that became a social media moment. And then Brandy pushed back on him on the internet. And then this is the kind of make good slash handshake moment. But also, who did it end up really serving? I'm not totally sure.
I think it certainly served Brandy more than it did Jack Harlow. I was shocked that I think Brandy posted about this, that she'd never been invited before but never performed or never won. And that was like really just shocking to me. But Lil Nas X could have done that so much better, so much funnier, like a much more engaging way. Just watching Jack Harlow get washed during his own set was embarrassing. It's like everything about Jack Harlow that reminds me of Charlie Puth or reminds me of someone else who was undone by their own corniness. He is like his own usurper in a way.
Was there a shark jump moment? Because I do feel like 12 months ago, the things that people are maybe bristling at now, maybe 12 months ago seemed novel, or 18 months ago seemed novel, and now they're maybe seeming a little overcooked. Was there a particular shark jump moment in your mind where that happened?
Totally. It was the album being bad. I like Talk of the Town, and then Young Harleazy, I was like, oh Lord, we might not make it through. And then First Class, I love, because it is simply the Fergie song. And then once I got to Dua Lipa, I'm like, this is the end. And then Dua Lipa followed up by Side Piece, killer.
Okay, I like Dua Lipa a lot as like a pop rap crossover club song. But when you transition from that to Side Piece and then Like a Blade of Grass later, and there's three or four songs mid to late on this album that all feel like they're trying to answer the same question. And that's a question that didn't need to be answered four times. And that, from a critic perspective, was a little bit frustrating for me because I feel like this is your breakout album. It's not your first album, but it's your breakout album. And so what you want to do is tell a complicated narrative about yourself. And I think the negative feedback on this album all kind of hovers around this is only one idea. Let's listen to Dua Lipa, which does not feature Dua Lipa, by Jack Harlow.
Being extra, she's a European and she know I'm seeing extra. Got a main character, but you could be an extra. Yes, sir. We the hottest out, used to be next up. Now I'm on some Ariana, thank you next, bruh. Shorty came from Lex and she flexed up.
Larissa, you talked obviously in your piece about the Drake stuff. Tell me a little bit, just on a raw level, how this album struck you, and then we can kind of get into the long Drake umbrella.
I didn't go into it thinking I'm about to sit down and listen to a rap album. I sat down and was just like, there's going to be some pop stuff on here probably. You know, the Dua Lipa snippet was out before the album, the First Class snippet, and then the song blew up, and then everyone hated the song, even though they loved the snippet, even though I don't think the song was finished when the snippet blew up, and I think they rushed to finish it because it sounds undone to me. But I ended up saving like 11 of the 15 songs on the album. I go back to Like a Blade of Grass a lot. I really like I Got a Shot. It's not anything mind-blowing. It's not reinventing the wheel. It's reinventing Drake, if anything. But I didn't think it was so bad that I couldn't get through the whole thing, which I saw a lot of people not be able to get through the whole thing. But I was listening to it the way I would listen to any other pop album that I wouldn't necessarily love every song on, but it's just like, this came on, it's fine. I thought the sample choices were interesting, and that was the draw for me. It was the referencing back to Kiss Me Through the Phone and somebody that I used to know and Glamorous, and there was no way I was escaping the grips of that. It just wasn't going to happen. And so I feel like I was the target audience for this in a way that a lot of other people were not. But I also was not a huge fan of Jack's first album, which was a lot more of his actual skill set being put on display, his actual storytelling being put on display. Even the songs on that album that I really loved, like Creme, just sounded like Drake songs to me. And I liked them because they sounded like Drake songs, because I think as a pop fan, Drake is the most accessible rapper just because he occupies both those spaces in the same way that like Drake is the Taylor Swift of rap kind of thing.
I'm actually interested to hear that you like that song, Larissa. So let's listen to it. Let's get into Like a Blade of Grass from the new Harlow album.
Met you in the dark trying to put that light on you. Could buy you anything, let me spend some time on you. Cause I want to. I think I want you to. I want you to.
It It reminds me of an anecdote, and I won't share who told me this anecdote because I don't want to like indict someone specifically. It was a friend of mine who's like roughly my age talking to a college student. This is like a couple years ago, a college student who wanted to work in the music business. And they were talking about Drake. And my friend was, of course, like, you know, I like Drake fine, but here's why a lot of people don't. And that person who was maybe 20 at the time was like, literally, why would anyone not like Drake? And it's interesting that generational divide where Drake is, and you talk about this in your piece, Larisha, Drake is the kind of alpha and the omega for a certain age group because it was everywhere from 2008 forward. You couldn't escape the influence. So it's only natural that we're now arriving at the first generation or maybe the second micro generation of like fully formed post-Drake rappers for whom the idea of being a rap star is actually being Drake, not necessarily being Biggie-like, even Young Thug or Future-like or whatever. It's being Drake-like. And that seems like that's not going to change. This is the beginning of the thing.
Jack Harlow is to Drake in the same way that Olivia Rodrigo is to Taylor Swift. It's very much like they are pulling from the same playbooks, or even like the Kid Laroi to Post Malone. Like, these are very clear lines that can be drawn about what these young performers learned watching these people, especially someone like Jack, who grew up in Kentucky. And I know he moved to Atlanta, I think, after high school. But from what I understand, he grew up in basically the countryside of Kentucky by Louisville. And, you know, there's not much to do out there. He used to read all the time. And in that time, in 2009 through 2016, Drake was inescapable and this dominating force. And if you're watching him become Drake and not just kind of hopping in as if like a young teenager now sees Drake as Drake, but when you see that happen in real time, you're taking notes along the way. And now that Drake has essentially taken Jack under his wing, the intentions of this slightly unclear. I don't know if it's a genuine friendship mentorship kind of thing going on, or if this is a callback to a Drake Weekend kind of situation. But I think there was not another trajectory that would have made sense for Jack, because he couldn't do a Machine Gun Kelly type pivot. He couldn't just ride hip hop until its endpoint for him and then get washed by Eminem and then go do rock music because he doesn't have a place in hip hop anymore. So he didn't really have a choice. He didn't really have a choice but to like double down and really say, you know, what's that line on, I forget what song, he's like, I'm hip hop, do you really understand? And a lot of people don't, is the thing. And I think they were listening to the album thinking they would come to understand. And I think he has some work to do, because I think a lot of the response to the album also was that he wasn't charismatic on the songs and he wasn't this personality that he's been made to be based on social media, based on him flirting with Sweetie on a red carpet, or that weird Emma Chamberlain thing from the Met Gala, or the chicken shop date episode. And that was never something he had really pushed in his music. So to see people being like, why is he not being charismatic? And it's like, 'cause who told you that he was?
We're talking about Harlow and Drake. So let's listen to Churchill Downs. This is the Harlow Drake record on the new album.
Yeah. Cold hearts and heated floors. No parental guidance. I just see divorce. Therapy sessions. I'm in the waiting room reading Forbes. Abandonment issues I'm getting treated for. How much water can I fit under the bridge before it overflows? My son's got a lot.
Hunter, who's wavejacking who? Is Jack Harlow wavejacking Drake, or is Drake wavejacking Jack Harlow?
I think it's definitely jacking Drake, because Drake is moving in a totally new direction with Honestly Nevermind. Like, he's playing in a different, with different colors, different ideas, with different sounds. The thing I keep coming back to about Come Home, The Kids Miss You is that when Jack Harlow gets to shoot his shot and make a song with Drake, he like tries to go in like this weird bar for bar two-hander song that is truly just rapping. There's nothing else. And Jack Harlow's verse is so reverential and deferential to Drake in a way that is extremely boring to listen to. But I'm like, you have this opportunity to make a song with Drake and make a song that like the kind of pop adjacent stuff that you are trying to do on this album. And you choose to rap with Drake in a way that feels like he has too many cooks in the kitchen, or like too many calculuses. He's trying to, like Larisha, you're saying, like, he is a rapper, is known for being a rapper, wants to do the pop stuff, or is becoming famous for doing the pop stuff, but it all kind of collapses once he tries to do it all at the same time. I don't know if that's it, but there's something there happening that is so backwards to me.
I will say this, when I interviewed Jack, I asked him specifically that question because I also was curious about that choice. And he was basically like, that's the Drake that I like most related to when I was younger, that version. And wanting to do a real rappy record almost as a symbol of respect for Drake's skill set and his own skill set, and basically saving the idea of what you're describing, which is like a big pop record, for some TBD future project. So that was intentional. Whether it was right or not, that can be an open question, but that was a pointed choice that he said he made, or that they made together. Now, Larissa, we talked about this a little bit before. To what degree are either or both of you familiar with the four Jack Harlow albums that precede the actual major label debut?
I've heard all of them. I revisit the poppier tracks on them, but I was never like, you know, early quarantine days when What's Poppin' was really blowing up. My first memory of Jack Harlow is hearing that song on TikTok, not knowing what he looked like. The music video came out and then everyone was shocked that he was white. And I was just like, okay, it's fine. It wasn't a song that I was like gravitating towards. And it was obviously a weird time to be listening to anything when the world was collapsing. And now he has better songs to listen to as the world continues to collapse, which I appreciate. But I feel like he didn't become like an actual interesting figure until around this time last year. And even that, it wasn't the music. And so much of what I feel like is being presented about him, no matter how hard he tries to make it about the music, has very little to do with that. And so I think even like the Drake thing, how you just explained how he explained it to you, it sounds like he knew that that would be the one that would kind of stir up conversation about what his skill level is and not, you know, can he make a pop hit?
Also, the one thing I would also say about that is if you make a huge pop hit with Drake on your breakthrough album, everybody will think Drake gave you the pop hit. Like the narrative about it will always be like, oh, that's a Drake song that you happen to be on rather than some kind of collaborative effort. So I wouldn't be surprised if part of the thinking was maybe I don't want to have to be subjected to that narrative if we do come up with a huge smash.
And it kind of backfired anyway, because that still happened, because the way that Drake was rapping on Churchill's Down, he doesn't even rap like that on his own stuff anymore. It was very much like I'm trying to not sun him, but like it, he can't help it.
It's a high-level, emotionally evolved Drake verse.
Yes.
It's a after-hours Drake. Good, smart after-hours Drake. Let's talk about the summer of What's Poppin', the BET red carpet, the Saweetie interaction. Because that is, I think, for most people, the awakening moment. Hunter, where were you when you saw the Saweetie red carpet footage? It's like the Zapruder film of our time. Where were you?
I think I was just sitting on the couch scrolling through Twitter and I was like, who is this person? What? Where did he come from? Who is he? I mean, I knew about What's Poppin', but then he'd sort of exited my consciousness. I mean, I have my own ideas and thoughts about Saweetie, but it was such a moment of like true funny horniness and goofy playfulness that I think it did set an expectation for Jack Harlow's personality and just even his like charisma that the music has not really lived up to, or does it in like a rap way, not so much in a pop interesting performer way. But no, I was just sort of like, you know, gleeful. I thought it was funny. It was silly. But at the same time, I don't know. I think the Jack Harlow loving Black women thing has become like too weird of a meme for me to like engage with.
Time to listen to What's Poppin'? I think so.
Down. Spending money at the club like Sam's. Yes, ma'am. She a little freak on cam, but she don't put this on the ground. Little boys trying to diss on the ground. Hey, I can't switch on the fan. It's how I hit the switch on the fan. This where my head is. I feel resentment from every direction.
Even okay, so this is the thing. And again, things that seemed novel 12 months ago now, I think, have been like kind of like the towel is being wrung out a little bit. But that demonstration of comfort, I think, really went a long way in terms of building a fan base and in terms of like that became as big as What's Pop. Like, you know, he described it when I interviewed him. He's like, that was a hit song. Like that one interaction, that was a hit song. And right around that time, I mean, I don't know how heavily you guys are on TikTok, but I just feel like my feed was 20% black teenage girls loving Jack Harlow. It was just like a very strange moment for a few months where it was like over and over and over again. And then that became the narrative. And now now that it's like become like meta conversation, it does feel a tiny bit overwrought. I feel that.
The thing about Jack Harlow is like, he's kind of in this impossible position where the only thing most people know about him is that black women love him, is that he loves Drake and is Drake's other son, I suppose. But the
very disrespectful to Adonis. Very disrespectful to Adonis.
I said other son.
I know, but Adonis is going to grow up and hear this one day and be like, I literally can't believe this woman said that Jack Harlow is biological kin. That's crazy. We apologize, Adonis. We apologize.
I just think that there's nothing else that he's ever asked about or talks about. No one really ever pushes him on the Tory Lanez stuff, where he defended not taking Tory Lanez off a song and then said, the only thing we know for sure is that Megan Thee Stallion was shot, and just kind of declined to acknowledge like any sort of fact about that night, that what happened between them. But yeah, I don't know. It's just he's out of moves right now. The Brandy thing, even then, he like kind of got outplayed in this very embarrassing way.
His shows seem very welcoming. I'm very tapped into stan culture and what goes on at the shows and what those crowds are like. And it always seems very communal, seems very respectful amongst these young women. And they just kind of want to show up for him and support him in a way that they would for Harry Styles or, you know, a boy band member, you know, whatever the case may be. And so when the whole story stops at he likes black women and we're not digging into what that means, what he's doing with that, how does he show that, anything beyond the fact that he does, just seems kind of lazy on everyone's part, including his, because it's just like, that can't be it. That's not a story.
Was it meaningful that he participated in and showed up at the protests following the Breonna Taylor murder?
I appreciate anyone using their platform to elevate protests and show up and support Black Lives Matter, but you don't get a pat on the back for doing the right thing.
I don't think that any of it is disingenuous, or I don't think any of it is like a play or some kind of like, I don't know, scheme. It is just like, that's the only thing that Jack Harlow is to me. That's the super narrative of Jack Harlow in a way that, like, Larissa, you're saying, like, it's not only his fault, but although he just hasn't given anyone anything new.
Drake started at a very similar age. He was, you know, early 20s, I believe, when he really started blowing up, and it was the same thing for him. It was just like, guys are gonna buy my albums, claim they got it for their sister, and the girls are gonna buy it for the pictures. It was the same, I'm a heartthrob kind of thing, even though I feel like maybe I was 11 at the time, so maybe I was too young to see Drake as a heartthrob because I just saw him as Jimmy from Degrassi in the wheelchair. And so I didn't really get it, but I was like, but the music is hitting, so it's fine. But then he also was aided by the fact that it was him and Wayne and Nicki, and he was really a part of a movement in a way that Jack is not. Jack is really kind of just in his own lane. I think Industry Baby was like a really interesting point for him, obviously for Lil Nas X, but also for Jack, just because it was him with this really fast rising star in a way that I think the only other person really occupying that space with Lil Nas X is maybe Doja Cat. And so, you know, he doesn't really fit in that trifecta, though. It can't be Drake, Wayne, Nicki, and then Jack, Lil Nas X, Doja Cat. It doesn't work.
That's an interesting point, that Drake being part of a movement, because Jack's fame, first of all, on the micro level, it's local, right? It's regional. It's, I'm a guy who comes from not a major city in the music business, so I can be a successful star on the terms of the locale. But that's micro. Then his actual breakout is essentially a TikTok breakout. So it's a totally decontextualized breakout. You don't really know, you don't know who he is, where he's from, what does he look like, what's his narrative, who's his crew, what scene is he part of? None of that is available. Now, that said, I think that freed him up. I think someone who was more closely aligned either with a scene, a crew, or an ideology might not have done the Lil Nas X record. But Jack, I think, was free to do the Lil Nas X record because it didn't go against anything that people knew about him. It wasn't like, oh, I come from a different part of the world, I come from a different style of music. It was just like, I'm a guy with a TikTok hit. at that moment. Not to say that he wasn't a successful regional rapper, but he wasn't known really very widely. So he can come onto Lil Nas X record essentially as an almost unknown quantity and then hopefully use it to mutual advantage. Do you think, Hunter, what do you think Industry Baby did for Jack in terms of the public discourse?
I mean, anyone who aligns with Lil Nas X, it's like printing money. Like, you're guaranteed a win because he can sell anything. And it's funny because everything that Lil Nas X can do so naturally, it feels like Jack Harlow's trying to self-generate all of like the online attention or pivot that into like something else. But no, I think the song was good. I think it was like he was playing with colors that he just doesn't do himself. Like the visual was so interesting. The performances were so fun and good. Lil Nas X has only charisma. Jack Harlow has a hard time translating that. And then, of course, again, he still does this like very genuine movement moment of allyship, even at the BET Awards, where he refuses to give in to like stupid homophobia and supports Lil Nas X at every opportunity. And that's very sweet to me. But there's just like a savviness there that I think Jack Harlow, maybe because he's younger and just is on the internet more, knows how to, if not capture or harness, at least replicate.
Is he funny? Do you think Jack Harlow's funny?
That chicken shop date episode that he did, I was like giggling and kicking my feet. It was very
the original like, one, like the OG. Yeah.
I think he's unintentionally funny. I mean, sweet, sweet, sweet semen. That is so funny, but also completely, like, he's being dead ass.
Yeah,
I have to agree.
You know, I think the thing with the Lil Nas X situation that I feel like was brushed away really quickly in a weird way was that every time he would be asked about collaborating with Lil Nas X on that song, he would say that there were people in his camp telling him not to do it. And no one ever asked him, you know, obviously he still ended up doing it, but who and why are they still in your camp? And what did they think that you collaborating with Lil Nas X was going to do to your image? Why are you keeping this person in your team and around you? Obviously that regional thing comes with a lot of loyalties because you can't help but look back at the people who got you to where you are, even though the internet played a larger part in that than I feel the people of Kentucky did.
We're going to get a lot of angry emails from Kentucky. I can't wait.
And I'm so sorry. I had a lovely time there. I really did. But I think...
Don't walk it back now.
Podcast at nytimes.com for all your Kentucky stresses. Just drop me a note.
The food was great. It was a time. But I think similar to the Black woman conversation, it's just now he's aligned with this queer conversation and all of these... Having this white straight man answering for all of these groups that he does not belong to is a choice on everyone's part. I think he's being very careful because of what Hunter is saying. He did have paralleled rise with the baby in a way. When that's not happening, when there's not some huge moment propelling these conversations forward, how are you showing up? And I thought the BET moment with the Lil Nas X shirt on the red carpet was a really sweet way to show his support, even though Industry Baby didn't get any recognition, despite being one of the biggest songs of the last year, and Jack got to perform, and Lil Nas X was shut out. And I think a lot of people were just like, well, why did he still go? And it's just, well, I don't expect him to shoot himself in the foot at this point in his career when he has one of the biggest songs in the country to support someone else. And I think as much as we would like people to do that, that's not how people's minds work when you're 24 and on this hot streak in your career.
Just one brief note of dissent on the whole BET Awards thing, which is that award shows in general are fake and silly and people should not be mad about them. They should not be excited to go to them, nor mad if they are excluded. That's just a whole sidebar. But that's a separate episode of podcast. We can come back to that in a future time. Hey, we can come back to that. And that includes the Grammys. That includes like the whole run of them, just all of them. But we'll come back to that in a future time. The last thing I kind of want to talk about, and we've touched on it a little bit before, is this idea of kind of like the special boy charisma of Jack Harlow, which obviously is easily memeable, also has real world consequences and materializes in certain ways. And I can't help but notice that Jack Harlow is cast in a movie very, very quickly before this album even came out. You know, he has commercial sponsorships with like New Balance and KFC and so on and so forth. That to me is all tied together of a certain kind of like, oh, this guy, he's appealing, he's charismatic. I'm sure there's someone in like an advertising/marketing boardroom who's like, he crosses demographics, blah, 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 blah. you know, as someone who's watched things like this for a long time, it's hard not to feel a little bit uneasy at the speed with which that has happened. How are you guys perceiving that part of his public-facing rollout?
I think it's hard because it's like, again, like a thing you're not going to want to pass up at that point in your career, just because it's like, I think a lot of young 20-somethings are stuck in the feeling like they have to say yes to everything that comes along, because there's this doomsday feeling kind of just lingering over this entire generation, feeling like there's a lot of questions about what's next in the future and post-pandemic stuff and trying to build your life when so much of your 20s has been consumed by this really weird time. And so you want to say yes to everything because there might not be a next thing to say yes to if I don't say yes to this thing. And so I can see him trying to get his eggs in different baskets just in case. I think he recognizes how much of his popularity is built around TikTok and viral moments and stuff on Twitter and these clips that have nothing to do with his talent and the one thing that he can 100% control. And so I think he's just trying to make sure that if that falls out, that he'll still be fine. But I think when you pair that with the whole thing of him all the time just being like, but I'm a rapper, it doesn't really add up.
Okay, last question, Hunter. What is the future of Jack Harlow's hair?
Maybe we're going to have a blowout era.
You think so?
No, I don't think so. I think he's probably just going to cut the curls, honestly.
Tight or like bald?
I think tight. I think he's going to go tight.
It's a horrible
idea. The
little
ringlets are so like baby cutesy to me. And I'm glad that like, he doesn't have those anymore. But no, I think he's going to go even shorter. I do think, though, that what LaRoche was saying, I think that he does seem to have this like scarcity complex, and that's why he's saying yes to everything. But the Jack Harlow brand is already so far beyond the thing that he actually wants to be known for. I have to wonder, like, will something like, I mean, White Man Can't Jump certainly won't hurt him, but it's like none of these things are additive. None of them feel particularly additive to me in a meaningful way. I'm very curious about the next Jack Harlow album because I think it will certainly be better. I mean, he'll hopefully have more stories, not about the girls in high school that didn't talk to him or whatever. Hopefully we can move on from that.
Just an important reminder that in order to build a house, you have to make sure you have a strong foundation. That's all we have to say. Hunter Harris, LaRoche Paul, a joy, a pleasure, and also a chaotic head scratcher. Happy to have you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
We will be back after this with Peter Rosenberg. Let's hit you with a little Jack Harlow, Tyler Harrow.
Locked in the house, but I'm plotting things. I brought a gang to the party with me. Five white boys, but they not in sync. No, they not in sync. No, they not in sync. Heard of JT. No, they not in sync. Heard of JT. No, they not in sync. No, they not in sync. No, no. No, they not in sync.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
They said it couldn't be done, and yet it's Peter Rosenberg on Popcast.
I want to know who said it couldn't be done.
Non-believers. You know who believes? God did.
That's right. I knew this day would come.
That's true. You know Peter from Hot 97, of course. You know Peter from the One Episode Life podcast. Peter and I go back a long way, and here we are on the same plane. We have arrived on the same plane, and it is a gift. It is a gift to be able to talk to you about the taxonomy of white rappers, which, of course, I know you have spent a great deal of time thinking about in your career. I have spent a great deal of time thinking about in my career. And the occasion of Jack Harlow certainly fires those engines up, at least for me. I got to assume for you as well.
Absolutely. It's funny, you know, without you and I speaking, it seemed that we kind of reached the exact same conclusion about Jack Harlow. And, you know, as two white hip-hop, longtime hip-hop fans, there is a lot of thought we put into white rappers. I mean, there's literally probably not one white rapper over the last 15 years that I haven't had some sort of falling in and out with, or, you know, there's some sort of standard that I have a tendency, and I think other white hip-hop heads have a tendency to hold white rappers to, and I think with good reason. And I think Jack Harlow has entered a space that is truly unique in terms of the careers we've seen of the white rapper predecessors that he has.
This is the thing that's most striking to me about Harlow. And I think let's start with him and then we can kind of work our way backwards, right? So the thing that is most striking about his ascent, the lanes through which he has arrived, and the nature of his triumph is he's trying to be what I would term, for lack of a better phrase, a centrist rapper. He's trying to be a rap caviar rapper, a mainstream rapper who maybe has a little bit of quote unquote pop or crossover appeal, if we're thinking in the 90s or 2000s terminology. But effectively, he wants to play with everybody who's big in the game right now and is not positioning himself as someone coming from an outside perspective trying to land here. He's sort of saying, no, this is where I'm born and raised, and why wouldn't I make records like this? I don't know that there's ever been a truly successful white rapper who took this position. And maybe the only answer to that, and this is, I don't mean this to be like a shot, maybe the only answer is Vanilla Ice, but that's a totally like
different thing. Yeah,
exactly. Very loaded. But do you feel that? Like, because even if you're thinking about Eminem, it's a different proposition.
Yeah, Jack Harlow, at this moment, when he came back out for his second album, I realized that we had never had, at least in my memory, a white rapper sitting right in the middle of mainstream commercial hip hop. In other words, for people who need more context, making music for a mostly black and female fan base. At least that's his desired intent. Now, with white rappers, they always have a tendency to garner a huge white audience, no matter what they do, whether they prioritize it or not. White people are going to find themselves some other white people. It's just going to happen. But in terms of the way he's positioning himself, Jack Harlow is mostly known for What's Poppin'. That was up going into this album. That was his seminal moment in music. And now maybe First Class is right there as well. But like with What's Poppin', he became a truly successful commercial club rapper, a space that's been occupied by white rappers momentarily, but they often cannot stay there. I mean, this is the space that G-Eazy wanted to be.
Yes.
I like G-Eazy. And I always feel like I need to add the caveat. I really do like G-Eazy. I actually think he got probably too little credit. I think he's a pretty dope artist, but he wasn't able, or at least hasn't been able to so far, stay in that space where he's reaching the mainstream black audience. He still has his fans, and with streaming music, you can always find your fans, but he's no longer occupying this mainstream commercial radio place that Jack Harlow has found himself comfortably in, culminating with a BET Awards performance this past weekend. Yes. In which he did a duet with Brandy and did a full basic, Brandy, like a dance routine. So he's in rarefied air right now.
I'm glad you brought up G-Eazy, because needless to say, I spent a lot of time thinking about G-Eazy during the Harlow rollout. Here's the thing about G-Eazy. Before G-Eazy really got on, when he was still a Bay Area local rapper, I always thought those records were good. They're catchy. They're a little bit self-aware. He had a character, but the character didn't eat him alive. He was just like a good rapper who happened to be kind of like a conventionally handsome, like slick hair white guy. The minute he signed, like for real signed, all of a sudden it was like, we're putting him with Britney. We're putting him with Pop Singer. And I think that no one on that team understood that every time they went in that direction, they were gnawing away at the potential for him to be a truly mainstream rap star. I think they kept removing him from that. And when I talked to Harlow, and you also talked to Harlow, you and Ebro and Laura, when I talked to Jack, he was very mindful of what pop things to say yes to and what pop things to say no to, and spoke very frankly about turning down what I interpreted to be those kinds of young starlet collaborations, because he understood that it would take him away from the audience that he actually is aiming his records for.
So it's a really interesting point, because G-Eazy found success with some of these collaborations, but in the long term, how did it affect you? And how did it affect the way you received? And so far, with the tutelage of DJ Drama, Harlow has really done a great job navigating the space in a way where I actually told him when I saw him for our interview, I said, watch out. This is the spot. You're in the spot right now where people are going to try to get you up out of here. This is the time when people are going to question, are you legit? Why did you have that hit? Who are you? I mean, full disclosure, he was going to the Breakfast Club the next day. I said, be careful sitting up there with Charlamagne. He will say that thing that could end you if you don't answer it exactly right. And so far, to Jack Harlow's credit, and the only reason I gave him this advice is because I think he's a good dude who deserves this opportunity. And because he is that guy, he has so far managed to handle all these things the right way. And I think sort of rewarded the people who have believed in him.
Let's listen to that G-Eazy Britney collaboration from a few years ago. It's called Make Me.
Yeah, easy. I don't care if it's a random person or the biggest star. Out in Vegas or a little bar, it's really not a difference if it's near or far. Listen, here we are. I need you. I've always wanted what was off limits. Staring at you till I'm caught in it.
With First Class, first the success of What's Poppin' and now the success of First Class, he is in a very unusual position. And he said very directly to me, he wants to be the guy. Like, he wants whatever the throne is, whatever you and I used to think of the throne as, you know, like generationally, he wants this generation's version of it, which then led to the conversation of, can a white guy have that throne? Number one, should a white guy have that throne? Is that even a culturally or intellectually viable proposition? He certainly has thought more about race and belonging more than any white rapper I've ever talked to. And I, like you, have spoken to basically all of them over the years. But he has certainly imbibed a lot of the missteps of his predecessors. Do you think that a white guy in this moment should be striving for the throne? The chair, whatever it is, or does it feel still presumptuous in 2022 to even be thinking in those terms?
I think it would be more presumptuous to not strive for it, to act as if I shouldn't really go for it because it wouldn't be right for me to be the guy. This is a complexity that I truly actually can relate to when it comes to being sort of a front-facing white person in hip hop. You're stuck at a crossroads between knowing your role as a guest in the culture, being super duper polite at every single turn, and risking that no one pays attention to you, or owning it, knowing that you want to be there, feeling you've done the work to deserve to be there, have the true appreciation for the craft and the culture, understand your position, but with all due respect, you're still going for it. And I think that is the way to handle it. Otherwise, it's like, so he should he play with kid gloves on just because it wouldn't be the right thing? I think the fact is Jack Harlow should always respect the craft enough, and every rapper should respect the craft enough that if they're doing it, they're absolutely going for it. Do I believe that he will get some blowback because of it? Sure. And is it ideal for the state of hip hop that the guy with the crown be white? I would say probably not, but that doesn't mean he shouldn't go for it. Rap is not the same as folk music, bluegrass, jazz, R&B, or anything else. It really is more of a competitive sport than any other genre of music. And if you go too soft and if you go too polite, no one respects you either. So I'm not going to lie. It's a tough position to be in, but I think the right answer is for him that he wants to be that guy. Will he ever be it? Will he ever get the linear title that went from Big to Jay and to Cole and Kendrick? I don't know, but I think he should go for it.
It reminds me of two different things. One, I'm sure you remember vividly, at Eminem's peak, one of the continual parts of the discourse was, does this mean that the future of hip hop is a bunch of junior Eminems? Has Eminem's success so irretrievably changed the dynamic, not just of the music, but of the fan base, that the only thing that can be sustained after this is essentially a bunch of Eminem juniors and white rappers for white fans? That's one thing. The other thing, and we're going to skip over like the backpack stuff of the late 90s, at least for now, which I know we both lived through in different ways. I'm thinking of the early 2010s, the quote unquote frat rap moment. Mike Studd, Sammy Adams, early Mac Miller, who was never actually a frat rap guy, but kind of lumped into that moment. There was that wave where you were like, wow, this really is just white guys rapping for other white guys. That's weird. And if one of these guys really takes off, that's going to be super unusual. If one guy takes off and then labels just come and be like, well, we're signing all these guys now, and that's what we're promoting. Because, you know, labels are agnostic and not invested in justice, really, of any kind, racial, economic, etc. Harlow seems to have like threaded some needle between these two spaces of being like, I would like to be a very big success, a la Eminem, but Eminem never had the specific songs or the nature of the fan base that Harlow seems to have garnered. But Harlow could have also, I know from talking to him, that he paid very close attention to why those frat rap guys, what they did wrong, and why they didn't really blow, for better or worse. When you think of Jack's positioning in relationship to those two threads of white rap success, where do you see him fitting in either or both of those discourses?
Jack is by nature the opposite of the rappers, you know, Sammy Adams and Mike Studd. Yeah, it was white boys rapping for white people. Jack Harlow's entire style and appeal was such that was just clearly not his intention, whether by design or just by the nature of who he is, the people he surrounds himself with, etc. He strikes you in a totally different way. And it's a really interesting subject because when you think about it, in some ways, the marketing of Asher Roth is sort of what doomed Asher, in spite of the fact that he was a great rapper with the best of intentions. He was victimized by I Love College in the fact that it made his entire early base this white crowd that ultimately is not going to be loyal to you for the most part.
If we're going to talk about Asher Roth, people might not remember what I Love College sounded like. I think it will be illuminating to listen to a little bit of I Love College.
I could tell you a story or two. Yeah, of course, I learned some rules, like don't pass out with your shoes on, and don't leave the house till the booze gone, and don't have sex if she's too gone.
One caveat I should add is that Asher was also very aware about race, but didn't necessarily make the early choices that were reflective of his conversational awareness about race. Just as a sidebar.
That's exactly. And remember, he was in an interesting situation where he's being managed by Scooter Braun, who's, as we've learned after, made to create pop stars. So it was an awkward fit, but I do think it was that early white base that made it challenging for him to grow. Jack Harlow has made a conscious decision to prioritize the black fan base the commercial kind of party fan base and live in that. Yes. And as a result, I'll tell you what, I don't think you're ever going to go to a Jack Harlow concert unless he does the typical white rapper move of when he senses things are getting tough, pulls out the guitar and starts trying to go rockish. Short of that.
Don't do it. Don't do it, MGK. Don't do it.
Short of him pulling out the guitar and basically giving up, I don't think you'll see a predominantly white crowd at a Jack Harlow show. I really don't.
One of the things that you brought up was who he surrounds himself with. And I do think that if you look back at a lot of the folks that we've been talking about, they were white, their teams, their crews, their immediate circles. It was not a particularly diverse or integrated circle. Jack's team is basically the opposite. He's the lone white guy in a behind the scenes group that's all black. It's all folks that come from where he comes from. It's the kids and the artists and producers that he grew up around. So that also, I think, hones your idea of loyalties, of what is my role here? Where are my ethical loyalties and responsibilities? Where do they go? And if you're constantly surrounded and reminded of that, hopefully you don't go astray. Do you think of Harlow at all in relationship to Eminem? Because like the more that we look at Eminem's career in the rear view, the more he seems like a historical anomaly in terms of the scale of success, even the style of music. And if you're going to look at people who are post Eminem in the culture, I think it's hard to find people who are post Eminem, not to take away from the importance of the music that he made. But I don't know that he set 1,000 rappers in his style into motion. I'm not sure of that.
Yeah, his style was too difficult to try to even mimic. It's like it doesn't even work. I do think M's an anomaly. And I do also think he's the only white guy who's ever had the crown. I do think there's a period there around 99 to 01, you know, or maybe 2000 to 03. In that range, you know, him, Jay, and 50 are kind of all vying for it legitimately. And I think he's interesting in that he's the only person, white guy, to ever be in that spot. And also, he did it because of like sheer aggressive care for lyricism and bars, not making great commercial records. In fact, I think most people who appreciate Eminem, myself included, see his big attempts at commercial music as probably the worst things he did. It's almost like M is great in spite often of the first single that he would drop off an album, whether it's My Name Is, Without Me, whichever one it was that Interscope said, let's get radio. He gave them the obligatory radio hit, but the things that were meaningful were coming on the second singles, The Stands, The Cleaning Out My Closets, things like that. So M is a really unique person in terms of where he sits in hip hop. And I don't think there'll ever be anyone who's directly related. I don't see Harlow as really that related to Eminem. I mean, yeah, of course, by a very loose association, but I don't consider them to be similar in any way.
If everybody's feeling nostalgic, I think we should probably get into Eminem's My Name Is, just to feel a little bit of what that old thing felt like.
Am I coming or going? I can barely decide. I just drank a fifth of Kool-Aid. Dare me to drive?
Go ahead.
All my life I was very deprived. I ain't had a woman in years, and my palms are too hairy to hide.
Whoops.
Clothes ripped like the Incredible Hulk. I spit when I talk.
One quibble that I would say with what you just said about Eminem is I do think he was making commercial records, but he was making commercial pop records, not commercial rap records. There were commercial pop records that happened to feature rapping, which frankly, if there is a long arc of Eminem influence, if that exists, and that's for a separate podcast, we can come back to that. But if there is, it's that he exploded the idea that truly commercial pop records had to be singing records. He understood that truly commercial pop records could be rapping records. And that's not to say that rappers did not have pop hits before. It's not to say that rappers didn't have crossover hits before. But oftentimes, they were crossing over sort of on their own terms. This is like a rap song that all of a sudden everybody's into. Those first Eminem singles, as you point out, from every album were pop songs that happened to be rapped. And that is something that I think at the time felt radical. And I think that's actually what shook people up. more than anything.
Right. And of course, for me as an underground college radio DJ, made me want to puke.
Right. But people also thought at the time he's skipping the line. He's not even going through. I mean, and of course he grew up in the battle scene, et cetera, et cetera. But from the casual observer, people like, damn, this dude just showed up and had number one pop record. And what the hell?
Yeah. And he didn't even have a number one urban record or hip hop record. Yeah. That is a fascinating difference. I'd also just like to say, cause I'd be remiss to not mention it in a conversation about white rappers, that when it comes to Jack Harlow, whatever he's going to do moving forward, I hope that he uses the trail sort of blazed by Mac Miller to guide him in two senses. In one, it's okay to make music that's not traditional rap if that is also truly a part of who you are and it's authentic to you and it's good. Because Mac's movements away from hip hop were probably the best music he ever made. And furthermore, and more importantly than that, to know and recognize the benefit of your whiteness, the privilege you're being given, to recognize that and do everything in your power to empower Black artists. Because when you really look around, I mean, the list, this is for another podcast, the list of people that Mac Miller directly lifted up and helped make stars and make money, it's up there with anyone ever in the short time that he was with us. So I hope Jack will use that as sort of the real standard for how you can be a sort of guest in hip hop as a rapper and also truly contribute.
Out of curiosity, when you've had other white rappers on your show or even on your podcast, you always try to engage them on the subject of race?
Yeah, basically. I would almost always, maybe there could have been times over the last few years that maybe it seemed even less interesting as they like came along more and more often. But I would say, I'm guessing I've never interviewed a white rapper without talking about their whiteness. My guess would be I never have.
Do you find as time has gone on that on average, and this is not a Jack specific question, but just in general, there is more receptivity to that conversation, more self-awareness, more understanding of structural racism, white privilege, etc. Do you find that that's more on the table on average now, or is it sort of still a special use case when someone kind of seems to get it?
I think most of the ones who make it that far along have some level of understanding. Like, I can't remember the last time that I sat with a white rapper. I don't want
to. No. You don't have to drag anyone.
Without disparaging, we all know Iggy Azalea had her lessons to learn. She's sort of an interesting case. She's not American. It was a little bit complex. I'm not trying to suggest it was easy for her to navigate. But she's one of the only ones I can think of who, when you talk to her, we're like, hey, I don't know if you fully get your positioning here. Because for the most part, whether it's G-Eazy, Mac, Asher, Jack, they've mostly all really won me over in terms of really believing they understood sort of where they stood and they were trying their best to do it in the right way. I could be forgetting a white rapper or two that I've talked to, but those main names that stick out, I actually thought they all were capable of having this conversation.
I also think that's a lot of those folks generationally came after. I mean, I'm sure you remember the Lil Whites of the world, Haystack, obviously early Paul Wall. There were other entire generations of white rappers who I think maybe people didn't broach those questions with because they were largely regional successes or maybe didn't break through at a level where they felt like, especially in a post-Eminem era, it was like, well, okay, they have hits or they're local, but they're not disrupting the ecosystem like Eminem.
Paul Wall is almost so accepted that he doesn't even get thrown around in the white rapper conversation because he probably should be the name we're talking about even beyond G-Eazy because he certainly had longer, more sustained success as a mainstream artist. And his name doesn't get thrown around that often almost because he is accepted as just such a part of the Black music scene in Houston. His whiteness is, of course, there. It's just when you think of Paul Wall, you probably think of grills before you think of his skin tone.
Let's have a taste of that Paul Wall from back in the day. This is Sitting Sideways.
Empire Wild, baby. It's the people's champ. I'm something like a bowler. The candy paint dripping out for the old school Impala. I'm with that big bank, Hank.
It's interesting how I do think regionality does play a role in this, because I do think you're right. Like, the specificity of Paul Wall's Houston-ness, especially arriving in that moment when Houston was really, really starting to come out onto the national scene in a major way, that narrative ended up sort of taking the front. And I think race at that time did not play as big a factor. And I also think you can be a white rapper and sort of say, like, I'm not going to take special opportunities that are afforded to me. This is what I was kind of getting into in the beginning about, like, the G-Eazy conundrum, where I think when G-Eazy showed up, it was like, damn, I'm going to take every opportunity. And it ended up kind of derailing a thing that was moving in a strong direction. Even hearing Jack be like, yeah, like, I understand that I'm getting these opportunities, but I'm not going to say yes to everything. Now, that said, he has said yes to some things. He already has a movie role. When I was watching the NBA Finals, I feel like every third commercial featured Jack Harlow. It's hard for me to not be a little skeptical of that and being like, damn, corporate America is just like, we're taking a bet on this guy. Like, we're placing big bets on him. You and I both know that's reflective of a racial conversation that a lot of Black artists are not allowed to be a part of. Jack Harlow has a KFC deal. Not that the fast food marketplace should be how we judge how successful a rapper is, but it is notable. And I'm sure you look at that and are kind of like, okay, that's a little bit of like, I'm going to scratch my forehead and just kind of keep an eye on that.
Exactly. And those are things he has to be mindful of. The more bags you accept, the more you're risking playing yourself. So it's a really fine balance of, I want to get some corporate money, I want to do my thing, but I cannot attach myself to everything because my credibility, I'm going to be analyzed in a different way. Travis Scott is given a lot of leeway to do Nike, McDonald's, everything imaginable. Now, listen, those people still may joke about it, but I do think with Jack, there's a different implication there that he needs to be super mindful of.
Well, Peter, when Jack Harlow either has ascended to the throne or has been washed into the dustbins, we will circle back for the mea culpa episode.
I look forward to it. I wish him the best.
Peter Rosenberg on podcast. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you, John. Thanks.
That is our show, our big Harlow extravaganza. Thank you to Hunter Harris. Thank you to LaRisha Paul. Thank you to Peter Rosenberg. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email me at podcast@nytimes.com. If you are from Kentucky, I'm sorry. We did not mean to hurt you this episode. Get in the Facebook group. Get on the Discord. Someone emailed me and said that they could not find the podcast Discord by searching podcast in Discord, which frankly, y'all know I don't know what that means. But to that person and others, if you're having trouble, go to the Facebook group. There is a link pinned at the top of the Facebook group that will take you right there. I will also maybe try to come up with like an abbreviated link that'll just be much easier for people to find. So give me a week to figure that out. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Google, Stitcher, etc. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with special assist this week from Brad Fisher. And also whoever designed the acoustics in my bathroom, thank you to you. Let's go out with one of my favorite Harlow songs. It's actually not on this album. It's on the last one. It's a collaboration with one of my favorite rappers working right now. It's ESTG. This is called Route 66. See you next week.
Just left out the city. It was high, high, high. Think they f***ing with me, but they not, not, not. I just cannot stop, I'm about to buy my bro a drop. She came to kick it with her friends, they taking shots, shots, shots. I'm a hot shot, hey, met her at the club and I took her to the casa. Get bread nonstop, know my name, ring a bell like Raja. From the city
like Raja. Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.